ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For decades, a quantum computer has been just around the corner. So, where is it?
If you'd asked me very early on, I would have been very pessimistic.
The race to build a quantum computer...
Then I got more pessimistic.
Can anyone actually do it?
And more pessimistic.
One of the biggest tech stories on Earth. I'm Jacinta Bowler. Search for Science Friction, Dead and Alive, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. If sweating with a group of people in a room sounds appealing, chances are you have sat in a sauna before. It's the popular Nordic pastime that is booming in Australia, but plenty of other cultures love sweating too. Think onsen, schwitz, hammam, a sweat lodge. What is behind our sauna fascination and how has the wellness industry cashed in? That is in the next 20 minutes. Also ahead, young people these days are less religious than previous generations, but among Gen Zs, men are throwing researchers a curveball. Plus, you know him as former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, but to his grandkids, he's yeah, yeah. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, the decision to have or not have kids is a big one. Maybe you've already got a couple and the thought of another makes you feel a little lightheaded. Maybe you're waiting until life feels a bit more financially secure. Or maybe you've just simply never pictured yourself as a parent. Whatever the reason, new research from Adelaide University suggests more Australian men are making that decision earlier than previous generations. The number of vasectomies among men aged 18 to 44 has jumped by more than 40%. And researchers are pointing to everything from cost of living pressures to changing ideas about family and parenthood. So are young Australians rethinking what a family looks like? Or is it financial pressures pushing people to make permanent decisions sooner than they otherwise would? Well, in a moment, you'll hear from someone who had a vasectomy when he was 30, knowing he didn't want kids. And I'm really keen to hear from you too. How did you arrive at one of life's biggest decisions? Whether you chose to have children or stop at one or two or not become a parent at all, what shaped your choice of how you wanted your family to look? With me is Daniel Finlay. Daniel, welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, Tegan. Thanks for having me.
Daniel, we've only just met, but I'm about to ask you some really personal questions. You got a vasectomy when you were 30. Why?
I've just known for a long time that I didn't want kids. And then I had a long-term relationship breakup over the change in needs and change in wants to having kids. And I thought, why not now? I might as well make that decision at some point. And it seemed like a good time to make it.
So it's something that you'd considered leading up to that point?
Yeah, for a long time. I mean, pretty much forever. I had never had a want to have kids. And then I think maybe when I was like 25, 26, I started thinking seriously about getting one. And then once the relationship ended, I was like, there's really nothing stopping me. And it's going to make the rest of my life a lot less frustrating and annoying and less to worry about. And it just seemed like one thing to take off the psychological plate. So why not?
A couple hundred years ago, Daniel, at 30, you might've been a grandfather. These days, it's a pretty young age to be making decisions about like family planning and stuff. What kind of reaction did you get from people when you told them about it?
I mean, you can probably guess it was a lot of pearl clutching, especially from, I kind of expected it from like people a generation or two above me, but I also got it a lot from like friends and peers and things like that, which I think like it can be expected to some degree. And it's still very, as I know the like pregnancy rates, like the age and things have pushed backwards a lot and people are getting pregnant a lot older now. But it's still very normalized to have kids in your 20s. And so the idea of someone permanently choosing to not do that in their 20s or like just at the end of their 20s is a very surprising kind of thing for most people to talk to someone and have that realization.
Did you push back against that?
It kind of depended who it was. Sometimes like you kind of get the same response over and over. So sometimes I was like, haha, yep, cool. I've been castrated sort of thing. But then for some conversations, I kind of went down into the reasons, the multiple reasons why I didn't want them. And I ended up having some pretty good conversations with some friends. Some people opened up to me, especially like I had one person reach out to me after we had the conversation in a group and was like, hey, I've actually been talking to my wife about this. We've been considering it. Can you tell me more about it? Like, how was it? What was the process like? Because that sort of thing. So that was really interesting. And then I also wrote quite a long article about my experience with it. And I had lots of friends reach out to me after that, who I hadn't talked to in a while, that kind of thing. Just saying that it reflected a lot of their thoughts that they hadn't been able to put into words. And I don't know, I was kind of touched by that. And that was really unexpected. I didn't expect to have several people kind of talk to me and say that they had similar feelings or that type of thing.
So you're kind of fleshing people out. You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm talking to Daniel Finlay, who has been so open about the fact that he decided to get a vasectomy at 30 that he wrote an article about it. And now he's talking to you and me about what went into his decision. It sort of follows in a theme. Adelaide University's found that men seem to be getting vasectomies at younger ages. There's been an increase in that younger age group getting them. And I'm curious to know what went into your family planning decisions, especially if you're a bloke. How did you kind of take charge of that for yourself? What age were you when you kind of knew what you wanted your family to look like? My number's 0418-226-576 if you want to send me a text. Frank says, I had kids at 42. It's the best thing I've ever done. Never say never. Also getting some texts from women. Linda says, I'm now 65. I chose not to have kids because of concern about where the world was going with the climate crisis and the threat of nuclear war. I don't regret it at all. So Daniel, what we haven't said explicitly is that you're actually an ethicist, which means your whole job is thinking about things really deeply. How did that, the frameworks that you've taken from ethics kind of play into your decision-making?
I think that they kind of, a lot of it bleeds in. Like I've been thinking about ethics and studying it for such a long time that it's not necessarily something I think about explicitly all the time. But I do love a bit of consequentialism, which is the idea that we make decisions based on the consequences of those decisions and think about the possible consequences and that kind of thing. And I think that framework has really changed the way that I think and act in the world. And so that has kind of affected this decision. I think it's not necessarily made me make the decision, but it definitely compounded all of the reasons why. So I think the main reason why is just that I've never wanted them. And I think from like a consequentialist perspective, I think parents should want to have kids, and it should be like that. That is the environment that creates the most comfort and gives a child the best quality of life. And so I think that is something that is necessary for a good childhood. But there are a bunch of other reasons why I think especially me in the situation that I'm in as like a white upper middle class kind of person, there are lots of other options that I have if I do ever want to have kids that I think are a bit more ethically salient for me. So like fostering, that kind of thing. And I don't know, I've just always had that, I guess, fallback where I'm like, I definitely don't want biological children, but even if I do, even if like the caller said, it, you change your mind, you never say never. Mm. I think I would still rather foster a child and give a child who doesn't have a good home environment or the possibility of having a good home environment, give them that opportunity rather than bringing a new person into the world.
It's a really interesting thought process to follow through, Daniel. Also here with us is Dr. Nick Catalaris, who's performed over 2,000 vasectomies. Dr. Nick, welcome. You're very qualified to be part of this conversation.
Hi, Tegan. It's good to be with you.
So you've heard this data from Adelaide University showing more men are getting vasectomies and at an earlier age. That's their data. How does this play with what you're seeing in your practice?
Yeah, so the data is really interesting, and it's basically showing that vasectomy has become a mainstream option and men are taking more responsibility for the contraceptive burden. I've seen a similar thing in my practice on a personal level as well.
Are they telling you what's going into that decision? Are they explaining their reasons to you?
Look, no two patients are the same, and everyone has different motivations for wanting a vasectomy. Now, in the Adelaide research, they postulate about cost of living and other factors, and that's certainly the case on a personal level in clinic as well. Patients often say, look, I've had enough kids, I can't afford to have another one, we're just done. Other patients may have had an experience where their partner had a very challenging pregnancy and they don't want to go through it again. So every patient is different, and I meet patients from all different walks of life with different motivations.
How many people are you seeing, like Daniel, who, young fella, no kids and not planning to have kids, and they're making that proactive choice?
Yeah, so Daniel's case is interesting, and I read his article as well. As the vasectomy doctor, I'm not there to kind of be the arbiter of people's life choices. And Daniel's clearly very intelligent, very well informed. And he's actually gone a step further than a lot of patients in that he was thinking about, you know, his future self and what that would look like. In other words, what would I do down the track if I suddenly wanted children, or I met a partner who wanted children? So that is becoming more frequent. And again, every individual patient is different. But yes, it is more common. However, look, the vast majority of men and couples that I see are those with children in their 30s or 40s, and they've completed their family.
Sure. Daniel, when you went to speak to your doctor about your decision, what kind of reaction did you get from them?
Not too dissimilar to my mum's reaction, to be honest.
What, he wanted you to give him grandchildren?
I mean, I probably should have seen it coming. He was the family doctor in my GP, so he was like, got his four kids, photos of them around the room. I probably could have seen that reaction coming, but yes, he was very much like giving me the spiel of, are you sure? Have you thought about it? Blah, blah, blah. Which I do, like, I did understand to some extent. I do think that there need to be safeguards and that people need to make sure that they are making medical decisions in a very informed way. But I was also at the point where I'd had that conversation with so many people prior to this, and I was going into the appointment knowing that I wanted to do it, and I knew I didn't need the doctor's consent to go and do it. The clinics don't require like a referral or anything. So I was kind of just there to be like, hey, you're a doctor. Do you have any suggestions? Do you have any tips? Do you have any, can you refer me to anyone that you know? And yeah, I was expecting a little bit more support, I think. And I went in and it was very much kind of, it felt like a bit of a stone wall. And I had to push back and be like, I've already made this decision. I'm just looking for some support.
It's interesting you say that. You're sending me your texts on 0418-226-576. One says, I think it's great men are taking control of their fertility after it being a women's responsibility for so long. I think it's empowering for them. I'm not a person who's ever sure about anything, but I've always known I don't want children. However, I faced a lot of doctors who just refused to help me get sterilised before I was 35. It is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with Dr. Nick Catalaris, who's a urologist who helps perform vasectomies, or he does perform vasectomies, and Daniel Finlay, who chose to have one at 35, knowing he didn't want to have kids. I'm really curious to know, if you'd like to share, it's quite personal, what went into your family planning decisions when you sort of knew that maybe you didn't want kids for sure, or your family was done and you took permanent action about it. Red says, hello, a male 35, been saving for a vasectomy. We are low socioeconomic since my first wife, third was, sorry. Since my first, third was born, child is nearly five. After two pregnancy losses and infertility, then nearly losing wife through pregnancy and ending with emergency cesarean. Not an experience I want to live through again. I've had my mind made up since I was 31. So Nick, we've got there a person who's saying, like, obviously quite a traumatic experience with their wife's pregnancy, but having to save up for this procedure, do we need to make it more accessible?
Look, healthcare can always be made more accessible, Tegan. Clinic-based vasectomy in Australia, the out-of-pocket cost is between $500 and $700, typically, depending on where you go. So it is expensive, but when you compare that with the cost of long-term hormonal contraception or an unwanted pregnancy, I think overall it's not too bad.
Another question here, it's actually a recurring theme throughout this conversation, Nick, on the text line, and I want to fact check with you. Magda says, vasectomies are reversible with around a 95% success rate. They're actually very logical for birth control with far less risks and side effects than most contraception focused on female anatomy. Nick, true or false?
So it's true in a way. I think it's a misunderstanding of what vasectomy reversal is. It's not like, you know, you change your mind and you go back to Bunnings and return something. It's a very technically challenging microsurgery that is a subspecialty within urology. And a lot of young patients have a misunderstanding that it's something you can just undo. It is reversible, that's true. With modern microsurgery, the patency rates after reversal are very good, but it shouldn't be seen in the kind of light that it was characterized in that message. It really is a permanent change when we're doing a vasectomy.
It's an interesting piece of caveat to put out there. Another says, after twins, my husband decided to have one. I still have mixed feelings 6 years later, but I figured his body, his choice. Daniel, it's interesting, this idea of the onus of contraception sort of being taken up by men. Do you think men these days are more aware of the need to be sort of an active participant in contraception?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I think that's a nice story to tell, and it's definitely something that I have thought about personally. But I do wonder if that is a general trend among men, or if it's potentially more of a selfish reason for the general populace who are getting it done.
So, Nick, if someone's listening or thinking about this, it's obviously something on a lot of people's minds, if the data's to be believed. What's sort of some general advice on how to make this decision?
So I think it's really important to be informed about the procedure and what your motivation is for having the vasectomy. There's no one-size-fits-all. Some young men are very well informed. They've thought about their future. They know the risks. They see it as a permanent procedure. And on the other hand, I meet some older people who really haven't thought about it as much, and their wife booked them in for the appointment. So it's just important that you've had a talk to the important people in your life. You've had a chat to your doctor. And you've really got a good understanding of what you're getting yourself into.
Well, Nick, Daniel, thank you both so much for chatting with me today. Dr. Nick Catalaris is Sydney vasectomy doctor, and Daniel Finlay chose to have a vasectomy at age 30. Thanks for sharing your stories as well on what went into your decision to make permanent changes to your fertility around family planning. Pete says, our third child's birth was very difficult. Emergency cesarean, nearly lost both wife and child. We were extremely lucky. I decided unilaterally that I didn't want to put my wife at such risk again. Another says, I'm a 34-year-old woman who is a child and adolescent social worker doing IVF. One of the hardest parts is being in the middle of wanting them, but also being able to see how great life could be without them. It's a constant discussion with my husband and myself every cycle and new transfer. I think of it like being on a boat trip. Both islands are great, but we're still stuck on the boat. All the very best to you. And you are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, why are Australians so hot for saunas at the moment? How are you keeping warm this winter? Maybe this has become part of your weekly ritual. That deep, piney heat, water hitting hot rocks, filling the room with steam. When it's blustery outside, a sauna is a very attractive proposition, and they're booming business. There was a time when saunas were something maybe you stumbled across at a day spa or a gym. Now they're popping up everywhere in Australia. Lakes, boats, backyards, beaches, car parking lots. For whatever reason, the idea of sweating it out with total strangers has absolutely taken off. Google searches for sauna in Australia have risen from about 120,000 searches per month to more than 500,000 over the past 5 years. Sauna's not new. Finland has built community around the sauna for centuries, and cultures all over the world have gathered in heat and steam as part of daily life. But the sauna boom here feels different. It's wrapped up in the language of the wellness industry, longevity, recovery, inflammation, biohacking. Do the health claims stack up, and is the sauna here to stay, or is it just the squash court of the 2020s, today's must-have obsession, tomorrow's empty building? Well, you're going to hear from a sauna expert and a sociologist who can give us the big picture in just a tick. But I do want to hear from you. Are you a sauna guy? Do you love a sauna? Is it a way for you to relax? What's your reason for participating in this sweaty hobby? Tell me how you feel about saunas. Here with me is Antti Rasinen, founder of Elite Sauna. He's part of the Australian-Finland Chamber of Commerce. Antti, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you, Degan. Thank you for having me.
What did sauna mean to you when you were growing up in Finland?
So sauna, for most of the Finns, like myself as well, has been a big part of our life all the way from basically when we were born. I remember, I don't remember, but my mum told me I was bringing a sauna first time when I was 3 weeks old. So it's a part of our sort of like a basic sort of like a family evening tradition, sort of like almost every evening or every second or something like that. And I'm not the only one. It's basically all the Finns are the same. So
3-week-old baby in a sauna. I'm pretty sure that Australian guidelines wouldn't recommend this, but this is just part of your culture.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, I bring my daughter three and a half years ago. I bring my daughter in a sauna first time when she was 5 weeks old. So, and it's not in a sort of like Australian guidelines in a sauna use or anything like that. But there's a lot of rules, and then there's, again, a lot of ways to go around the rules as long as you know what you're doing.
Okay. So in addition to sitting in them, you also build them. How did this get started for you?
Pardon?
How did you get started building saunas?
So I've been building some saunas back in Finland, as all the carpenters have. So in Finland, basically every single carpenter builds saunas. There's saunas so much in Finland. But when I came in here, I sort of like find a Finnish family who run a sauna business back in Melbourne that time, the name Finlio. And I sort of like I found them and started to work with them from the day one when I came to Australia 11 years ago, and I've been building them since.
So you've been in Australia for just over a decade. How have you seen the popularity of saunas change over that time?
Basically every year. The popularity of the saunas have been growing all the time, quite, in a way, quite steady. But then when the COVID time came, that was quite of a big boost for when the people started to be a little bit more sort of like spending more time in their homes and sort of like just finding a way to spend their time and do whatever they enjoyed in home and saunas. And especially like a private home saunas came like in this massive surge of people looking at the saunas in that time. And I think since the COVID started like 2020, 2021, the saunas has been just boosting in more and more the people's use of them.
Do you think people here are embracing them in the same way as you remember people treating them in Finland?
Yes and no. So it's a, for me, I don't know. Of course, I cannot speak for all the Finns, but for me, and I guess most of my friends are like that, saunas has always been a part of like a just a basic lifestyle, sort of like a every night kind of thing, every second, every third night kind of thing. And it's sort of like it's just a part of our basic lifestyle. We just used to go there always with the shower just before the bed or like that. It's a part of a relaxation and sort of like just enjoyment kind of thing. Whereas in here, especially now, because of my work that I've been building saunas, I've encountered a lot of new sort of like ways, especially new for me, the how to use the sauna. And these are like people are using it for all sort of variety of reasons, like some sports people use it for part of their workout routines, not even sports people, but any people really. And then it's sort of like an interesting thing, new thing for me has been this sort of like a performance style use. So people actually try to get really like a good results in sports and good results in their different kind of workout routines and sort of like people have been seeing it as a tool, but not only the way of relaxation or like that. So it has been a new thing for me a little bit, but same time it's quite exciting to see that there is many ways to use that very sort of like a normal thing for me. Sure.
So yeah, that performance enhancing side of things. You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Antti Rossinen, who's the founder of Elite Sauna, part of the Finland Australia Chamber of Commerce, talking about his memory of sauna at home in Finland versus what he sees in Australia with this explosion in popularity here. I'm really interested to know from you if you're a fan. What's the draw card for you? Are saunas a flash in the pan or are they here to stay? Well, you're texting me. One person says, currently on site building a wood fire sauna on a trailer that will travel through Victoria and Tassie this September, popping up in regional and wild places. Monica says, I love sauna. Just came back from Helsinki and experienced a true sauna. I wish we had it here. The saunas here, I can never sweat. So hopefully get the real thing here. Whereas another person says, I prefer onsens to saunas. So much more relaxing when it's cold, especially outdoor onsens midwinter. A shame they largely only exist in Japan. Well, also here with me is Dr. Jennifer E. Cheng, a lecturer in sociology at Western Sydney University. Jennifer, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So it sounds like we're really big into communal bathing in a way that maybe we weren't a few years ago. What do you think's behind this shift?
So as Antti referred to, it's partly to do with the whole COVID lockdowns where people were, you know, shut off from society. They were told to stay home, don't go out, don't interact with people, it's dangerous. And then when things opened up again, people were seeking connection. They wanted to meet people, talk to people, and find ways to connect. And so sauna was a way to do this in a kind of, you know, non-awkward way. So you were doing sauna, but, you know, just casually you can have a chat with the person next to you and connect that way. So it's just like a casual connection.
The communal sauna rather than the individual backyard sauna that Auntie's also being asked to build for people.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that has contributed to this, like, explosion of, saunas.
So the Finns don't have the lock on sweating together. What other cultures do we see people sitting around getting sweaty together?
So it's a really big thing in Japan. So they have their onsens. It's a real cultural thing. It's just like in Finland, it's just a part of everyday life. And you might find this quite mind-blowing, as I did. I have a Japanese friend who said you would go with your work colleagues all the time to the sauna. It's like, we have Friday night drinks. They go to do onsen with their colleagues and they do it naked. And it's compulsory to be naked. So can you imagine going, doing onsen, doing a spa with your colleagues completely naked?
Respectfully, no thanks.
But for them, it's completely normal. You would just do it and you kind of have to do it. It's a social thing. Like it's a social faux pas not to do it, like not to participate. So it's just a part of their everyday life and a part of their culture that they don't even think about that much. They just do it.
What are they getting out of that?
Sorry?
What social function does that play?
Gosh, I think it's just part of their social life, and it's not only about the adult world either. These onsens, some of them are quite big complexes. They include families. They allow kids. They have actual, places for the kids. So like actual, activities and things that the kids can do there, they're completely welcome. Whereas I feel like here the saunas and spas are totally off limits for kids. They're only for adults. It's very exclusive places. And so it's for them like a family, you know, fun day out. You just go there, spend the whole day there. You would, you know, go in the spa, go in the sauna, you would run around. There might be some, you know, even some pools and slides and things for the kids. You would just go and have a great day out. It's just a part of life. It's not something super special or exclusive. It's not expensive. It's about $20 per person for the whole day. So, yeah, it's just a very normal thing to do.
It's so interesting listening to that community aspect that you're talking about, Jennifer, and also hearing it coming or seeing it coming through on your texts. You're telling me about how you feel about saunas. Mostly very, very positive, although Lee says, I'd rather be stung by 1,000 bees than sit in a sauna. So boring and so hot. However, most of you love it. Purgy says, I've been enjoying saunas since joining the Navy in 1976. My best experience was using a sauna in Finland on holiday. It was situated on a jetty in a lake and we jumped into the freezing water after each session. By the third session, the lake was quite refreshing. Another says Perth is inundated. Saunas, ice baths, magnesium pools, saunas with ocean dips and lake plunges, sauna temples with Roman bath-style shared ice pools and heated magnesium sections with steam rooms and three different temperature saunas. They're booked solid. It's amazing. And the best thing, I love listening to the alcohol-free conversations men have in particular. So, Auntie, in that text there, we've got on one hand something really wholesome, people coming together, but also a very premium experience and they're booked out. Is that in keeping with the Finnish culture of everyone coming?
Yeah, kinda. So in Finland, there's a lot of different kind of public saunas. I actually research a little bit information about this. There's like a 50,000 different sort of public saunas in Finland, and that means hotels, aquatic centers, spas, institutional facilities, all sort of different things. That means some of them are hundreds of them are accessible entirely free, or just like you can give money if you want for some kind of collection or something. Some of them are really expensive, sort of like more like a massage spa style houses. So people are sort of like find their own way to use them, and however. Some people likes to go a little bit more private setting. Some people actually enjoys a lot of the social aspect in that. And like that's for me and most of my friends and my family members, socialization in sauna has been always been a big part of a sauna use. So it's kind of like something I ask also from my clients in here in Australia, that do you want, what is this sauna for? Is it for a couple? Is it for family? Is it possible for entertaining? Because saunas is very entertaining, is a very important part of the sauna culture in Finland.
Jennifer, how has the wellness industry involved itself in sauna culture?
I think it's kind of taken it on and really used it to for this market kind of driven, profit driven kind of activity. So they've turned it into a kind of a commercial thing. Rather than a cultural thing, it's become a commercial thing where, you know, you go, you pay your fees, you stay for 1 hour or 2 hours, and then you leave again. It becomes very exclusive and market-driven.
Do you think we can protect cultural experiences from being changed from what they were intended for, Jennifer?
It's very difficult because you can't say someone owns this culture. Like you can't say, a sauna has been painted and, you know, there's a patent on it. You can't take it and make your own sauna. So it's very difficult to do that. So I guess it's just up to the consumer to decide, like, if they like it, they will go for it. And if they don't, then they won't. I think, fortunately, yeah, it's market driven by what consumers want.
Well, Auntie Jennifer, thank you both so much for chatting with me today. Dr. Jennifer E. Chang, a lecturer in sociology at Western Sydney University. Auntie Rasanen, founder of Elite Sauna, part of the Finland-Australian Chamber of Commerce. And thank you for all your texts. Lots of big sauna fans on the text line. My recent addition to my sauna experience, writes one, was buying a good quality sauna hat, which allows me to stay in the sauna for longer. On getting nude in front of your colleagues, one says, I think a lot of Australians are uncomfortable when they're with their bodies. Perhaps this is the reason why we don't embrace it as much as the Finns and Japanese. Whereas Laura says, we lived in Innisfail, far north Queensland, for 6 years and without air conditioning. When I suggested to my husband that we go to Vietnam or to a sauna, he replied, I've lived in North Queensland. I don't need to go and sweat anymore. However, Laura says, I loved onsens in Japan. Well, it is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, which former Prime Minister can be seen playing pirates with his grandchildren in Sydney Harbour? You'll find out next. From commanding the halls of power to playing hide and seek in the halls of his house, former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has a lot more time on his hands to devote to his favourite activity, playing silly games with his grandchildren. All throughout July, I have been introducing you to a new side of prominent Australians as part of our Grandparent Trap series. You've met grumpy grandpa Bruce Pascoe, actor Lynn McGranger, whose twin granddaughters are only a few weeks old. Now, here's what grandparenting has taught Malcolm Turnbull.
Hi, I'm Malcolm Turnbull. I'm former Prime Minister, but most importantly, grandfather to four grandchildren, two of whom call me Baba and the other two call me Yeye. I was called Baba by the first grandchild, Jack. The general tradition is that the first grandchild has naming rights over grandparents. The only problem with that is that our son's wife is Chinese and Baba in Chinese is dad. The Chinese word for the paternal grandfather is Yeye. So I am Yeye to my son's children and Baba to my daughter's children. I asked the grandkids what they thought I did. You know, they said, oh, you're always explaining things to us, you know, which was said in a positive way. But it's interesting, Jack, a few years ago, as the grandson, he did a painting for school, which was a picture of me paddling in my kayak. And he said, my Baba loves me and I love him. He is important to me because he explains things to me and I like playing at the beach with him. You know, yesterday I was in the city with them, with Lucy, and I was talking to our granddaughter about the history of some of the buildings in Martin Place, and we're talking about how, you know, they'd been banks of one kind or another, and going to some of the history, and I don't know how much of that they soak up, but that's the sort of thing I bore my grandchildren with. But they, you know, they're very polite. They give every appearance of being interested. I asked Lucy whether my grandparenting style was different to my parenting style. And she said, well, the difference was that when the kids were young, you were very busy, you know, so really, really busy and travelling a lot and on the phone a lot. And of course, you know, since I stopped being Prime Minister, which is most of the grandchildren's life, because they were very little when I was Prime Minister, tiny, you know, I've got more time in my hands. I loved going on expeditions. Well, one thing we used to do, we've done a lot over the years, is take a little inflatable boat out to Shark Island, and that's always been good. We've done that for years and years and just gone and scampered around the rocks and, you know, played pirates and all that stuff. And I did that with my own kids. And I mean, there's a lot of experiences that you have, particularly if you've lived in the same city all your life, as I have with Lucy, a lot of things you do with your grandchildren that you've done with your children. At least for me, my grandchildren make me feel younger. Not that I feel particularly old, but they do make me feel younger, because I'm doing things with a, you know, 10-year-old or a 9-year-old or an 8-year-old the last time I was doing these things, I was 30 years younger, right? And so that's a sense you're repeating, you know, really beloved, important, touching parts of your past with another generation, with your grandchildren, and it does take you back to the generation before when you were doing those things with your own children. I really enjoy the company of my grandchildren. They're always interesting, and I don't have problems with them being badly behaved, to be quite honest. They're probably well behaved, and I think grandfathers have a little bit of an authority thing going on there that they sense, you know, and so they're a bit better behaved than they might otherwise be. You've got to have something going for you.
Former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull in granddad mode, I should say bubba mode. It's been a reinvention, a new identity to step into after politics. And that is what I'll be diving into on the next instalment of The Grandparent Trap on Monday. How grandparenting can come at a time of life when your old identities don't fit anymore and you can do things differently than you did the way you did when you were a parent. The opportunities for transformation can be pretty profound, and I'll be bringing your stories of reinvention as a grandparent on Monday. If you want to tell me your story before Monday, you can send me an email, lifematters@abc.net.au. Email me how being a grandparent has helped you reinvent yourself, lifematters@abc.net.au. Coming up next, is your grandson suddenly keen to go to church? For decades now, we've been losing our religion. Census data has consistently shown that with each generation, we're less interested in maintaining a relationship with whatever gods we may have had in the past. At least we're not doing it in the same organised, institutional way we used to. Until now. New analysis shows that Australian Gen Z men are back in the pews. Well, maybe. They're at least turning to religion at higher rates than their female counterparts. How widespread and entrenched is this trend? Is it something you're seeing? I'm about to get into it with our resident sociologist, but I'd love to hear from you. Have any of the young people in your life returned to religion, especially young men? What has this looked like? 0418 226 576. Tell me about the young people in your life and their relationship with religion. 0418 226 576. And here with me to unpack it is Professor Dan Woodman, sociologist from the University of Melbourne. He joins me fortnightly for social studies. Welcome back, Dan.
Good morning, Tegan.
I want to ask about your religious background, if you're happy to share it.
I grew up going to a Catholic church every Sunday, and then drifted away from it, but still probably have that kind of cultural identity. But it's a really cold morning in Melbourne this morning, and I came into the studio wearing my footy scarf, and I'm very passionate about that. And that's arguably the true religion of this country these days, the footy team anyway.
Interesting. Okay. I want to unpack that with you later, but first of all, let's talk about Gen Z men and this new Aussie research.
Yeah, so this is some numbers from the Australian Electoral Studies Survey, and they've been crunched by Intifar Chowdhury, who's at Flinders University. So as you were saying, there has been this steady decline in religious affiliation in Australia across time and across the generations. And that's continued, but there is this interesting little thing where there's been a gender flip where up until now, and still for older generations, women have been more likely to express a religious affiliation than young men. So we're seeing that kind of flip around, and now it's the men who are saying that they're religious and less so the young women.
So it's sort of in comparison to their cohort. It's not like they're all sort of suddenly clamouring to halls of worship, but it's just a different trend to what we've seen previously.
Yeah, that's right. So Australia's still a fairly, well, and absolutely, in kind of international terms, we're a secular society. So a couple of evenings ago, I did an online workshop talk for the Ghanaian Sociological Association, so my colleagues over there, and that is a society where something like 98% of people say religion is important to their life and society. Here in Australia, it's 14%. And they opened my talk with a public prayer, and then the person introducing me said they were blessed by the Lord to have me there talking to them, and none of my Australian colleagues have ever put it like that.
Okay, so
we're still not flipping it around where there's a massive revival of religion, but there is maybe a flattening out or even a slight uptick in just recent years. So there's been a few other studies seeing the same thing with young men's religious affiliation, but young women and overall, it still continued to go down.
Dan, any day I'm speaking to you is a blessed day. I do want to say that. So that all of Australia can hear. Tell me about the kinds of guys that are more likely to be religious.
So the interesting thing about this is that it seems to be mostly about saying that you have a religious affiliation, so less so than participation. Mm-hmm. And also if you take a broader view of belief, if you add in spirituality, it's young women are still at least as likely and maybe even a little bit more so than young men. So it's particular almost identification with a mainstream religion. So it's about saying that this is part of my identity, something I think is important and good for society more than I'm actively living a Christian life necessarily. And also that they're not necessarily going to church any more than they used to. And it still tends to be older parishioners that are going along.
Mm. It is Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm talking to Professor Dan Woodman. He joins me fortnightly for our chat, Social Studies. We're talking about some new Australian research showing religious affiliation among the generations, and in general, it's been declining. In general, in any particular generation, women are slightly more likely than men to say that they're religiously affiliated, except for Gen Zs, and we're unpacking that research now. If it's something you've seen in your family or life or your own life, I'd love to know what it looks like, if it's participation, like Dan said, going to church, or if it's just more like identifying with a religion. You can send me a text, 0418 226 576. So Dan, we're saying religion in a big catch-all term. What religions are we actually talking about here?
So the research I've been looking at doesn't go into that level of detail. So Australia is a more multicultural and religiously diverse country than it used to be, but we're still talking primarily about like a society that the major religions are still the Christian religions. And there has been a little bit of a trend in some other countries where some, I guess, more conservative beliefs about gender, so that kind of manosphere ideas of about gender relations have had some overlap or made those influences have made some connection to Christianity. Of course, within those churches, there's lots of contestation about this and people are unhappy about it and say they're misinterpreting a more complex set of arguments about gender relations. But there is some evidence that these young men who are saying that religion is important to them are also tapping into a kind of broader challenge of working out what it means to be a young man who's living well today and what that means in terms of masculinity.
There's on that exact point, there's this text from Claire who says, "My son, aged 15, has started attending a youth group and Sunday services independently. As a recovering Catholic, I have mixed emotions. I think religion is probably a helpful dimension to add to his life, but I believe it's all made up. I do worry about the gender beliefs being taught in his church, but maybe this is part of letting him go into the world and make his own decisions." Dan, what do you say to that?
Yeah, so like putting aside the question of, you know, that from the caller about whether it's true or not, I guess sociologists do see it as kind of a key part of culture over time. It's something that gives us lessons about what it might mean to live well, but it's also a sense of community. And in my own research looking at this age group, they do talk about that challenge of community and how hard it is to catch up with people. Plans always get cancelled. Church and church services are one time where you can say, you know, I turn up at this time on Sunday every morning. There's going to be a community there for me. I'll see some of the same faces that will smile and say hello. So it absolutely can bring community to people. It's not the only way. It can, but it also does tie into a set of beliefs that are almost by definition, maybe move more slowly or a little bit more conservative than other spheres of society.
So there's this sense of community if you're attending services, or maybe you've found an online community of people who think the same thing as you. There's also a sense of like a meaning making about the world. What's the difference between a religious affiliation and just sort of spirituality in general?
Yeah, so that's one of the interesting things about these patterns. It seems to be about that identification with the religions. If you do widen it out to interest in the divine, things beyond and spiritual elements of our life, then the gender pattern isn't there so strongly. So the secularization Australia and other places have gone through is partly about a shift away from the really structured mainstream religions, more so than people completely turning to, I guess you would call it, that kind of rational, non-divine kind of the world is just the material world kind of way of looking at the world. So spirituality is still out there. And we do live in this world where meaning making is still important to people, but it seems so complicated and messy. And it's almost like it's not so much that spirituality and religion disappears, but it becomes part of this whole kind of project of self-making that people come in and out of over time, or maybe shift their affiliations and what they believe over time in a way that people didn't do, but was also maybe not so possible for the oldest generations alive today.
Yeah, I wonder whether this signal is something you see as a trend settling in, or if maybe it's a blip.
So I don't think we're suddenly going to see a return to a highly religious Australian society. But yeah, I do think this search for meaning, and one in which people maybe trust other institutions less, might mean that we do see this pattern continue at least for a little while and maybe increase. So who knows? Maybe in the next few years I'll have a few more of the young men in my lectures feeling like it is truly a divine blessing that they get to come along and hear me speak.
As I said it here first, Dan, it is a blessing. We're blessed to have you. Thank you again, as always.
Thanks, Tegan.
Professor Dan Woodman, sociologist from the University of Melbourne, joins me fortnightly for social studies. If there's something you want Dan to talk about, send me an email, lifematters@abc.net.au. Love hearing from you. And you're telling me how you feel about this religion uptick in young fellas. Kay says, is it to do with a perceived loss of control? Women have traditionally also been metaphorically under the thumb, and now we're taking more space up in the control of what happens to us. Sally says, I hear tradwives when I hear young men are turning to religion. And Amy says, yes, this uptick in religiosity among men scares me. I see links to the manosphere. My violent former husband was more Catholic than most Catholics. Well, you are listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. It's nearly all we've got time for together here on Life Matters. I have come to you today from Jagera and Turrbal land. Now, I don't know if you caught the top part of the show. If you didn't, maybe go back and listen to it on an ABC Listen. We were talking about the fact that younger men in greater numbers are making permanent family planning decisions, i.e. getting vasectomies. And you were telling me your stories. One says, my wife and I were always apathetic about kids. We gave it a go and were told we needed IVF, so we decided it wasn't right to force it. We love our child-free life to travel, change careers, etc., but there is always a ghost ship, which is a turn of phrase I love. David says, I was a camera person for the ABC's Nationwide in the 80s. I filmed a story on family planning in Thailand where I witnessed around 200 men getting a vasectomy on a bus in a marketplace. After two children, I was happy to have a vasectomy to share the burden of fertility planning with my wife. Kyle says, my brother got a vasectomy in his early 20s while still in university in the early 90s when he got engaged. He and his wife have always seemed happy with their choice, but he told my parents we can't have kids to ease their angst. It's always been tricky for me as I kind of had to cover for him when my mum was chatting to me about them and feeling sad for them. Well, that is it for Life Matters. Beverly Wang will be with you tomorrow talking about how to embrace uncertainty. Don't miss that. And I'll be back with you again on Monday. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.